Live from Los Angeles, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by California Assemblyman Rocky Chavez, Alan Hoffenblum of the California Target Book, political analyst Sherry Bibich Jeffy, and Nigel Rabb from Loyola Marymount University. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base in California at the Westwood One Studios in Culver City, where our toll-free lines are now open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. You want to tweet your comments or questions at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And our website is beyondthebeltway.com. If you missed the broadcast any week, it is always found there, the podcast and also the video version for those who are interested in the Chicago video version of this broadcast. You can find it at beyondthebeltway.com. We keep shows for many, many months, even years. So, again, it's a place for you to go if you miss us on Sunday night. The topic of the evening is obvious. We're going to be talking about the tragedy in Paris this past week, 17 people dead as a result of terrorist activities in that city. At the moment, 40 world leaders have been joined by close to 3 million French people, about 1.5 million of them in the streets of Paris, others surrounding cities in Paris, in France, rather, really showing a solidarity against the horror that took place earlier this week. I want to get reaction from all of our guests, and I would be very interested in hearing from everyone out there in radio land as well, because the world media has now focused the attention on the way in which the French people and the West have responded to this. I'm wondering how those images are playing in the minds and hearts of those who are either ISIS or Al-Qaeda. Are they applauding the way the world media is giving this the publicity and the broad coverage that they are giving it? Nigel Rabb, let me start with you from Loyola Marymount University.
Well, I think there's always a risk that if we overemphasize our reaction, that yes, they will think of this as a success. And I think there was an article in one of the French newspapers where a major journalist was saying, I'm not going to attend the rally. I'm not going to go to the rally because if I do, I will be basically sort of saying that these were martyrs for a cause, and I will be, you know, playing the game that they've asked us to play. So I think there's always that danger.
Sherry Bibich Jeffy joins us. Go ahead, Sherry.
I think it just energizes ISIS and the recruitment process for ISIS, I think it may also energize what the media is now talking about as independent cells and independent individuals who want to have a name, who want to be visible, who want to make a statement as a member of Islam, as a member of ISIS, if you will, as a potential member of ISIS. I don't think it does anything else but really rev up the energy of the opponent.
Alan Hoffenblum, longtime Republican activist, but now the head of the California Target Book.
I agree with both, but I also agree what the Parisians and the French are doing in Paris today. There has to be reaction to such violence, and it's very, very necessary. I do believe that the radicals will be motivated, and it's a war. But we have to speak up, those of us who believe in democracy and free speech, how abhorrent we found what was done. We can't ignore it because we hope that a group of radicals and sociopaths, you know, maybe.
The Prime Minister of France said today it's a war against radical Islamism. Mm-hmm. Not just a war. He used the terms that a lot of conservative Republicans wish that President Obama would use.
Well, it is a war against radical Islamism. And I think Obama, there is a perception out there that he has been overly cautious in not wanting to offend honest Muslims who are not radicalized, which is the overwhelming majority of them. But I think he's been too reticent. And he's not acting like the leader of the free world at the current time, in my opinion.
California Assemblyman Rocky Chavez joins us, Republican from Oceanside for 28 years. He's been in the United States Marine Corps, colonel, retired, and colonel and assemblyman. Thank you very much for joining us. Your reaction to the question as to whether or not the way in which the West and the world are responding to this, given the fact that there's a strong media focus to this, are we in some way helping those that want to do us harm?
Oh, yes, we are. Because, you know, the real impact of terrorism is to cause fear. And so if the populations become fearful and change their activities, then they accomplish the one. But I think the bigger issue is this, is that since the containment theory is no longer a value at the fall of the Soviet Union, we've had world instability. And when you have a world instability, we haven't had either Republican or Democrat leadership that came back and saw, what is the role of the United States for the next 100 years? Since we've been floundering, then you start seeing destable situation economically, and now you see the Islamic terrorism. And keep in mind, terrorism is only a component of warfare. You know, when you have a strong military, you can take on a battle on the field. That's one thing. But when you have a weak enemy, you use guerrilla warfare as in Vietnam, or you use terrorism in this situation.
But when you talk about the way in which people react, though, if indeed the estimate is correct, if 3 million French men and women have taken to the streets today, 1.5 million in Paris, is that not a signal that at least the Parisians are not going to be forced into their houses? They're going to be in public places, and by being in public places, there is security problems that arise there.
Yes, Bruce. I remember reading the history books about how America and much of Europe responded during Nazi fascism at the beginning of prior to World War II, when the Germans were mobilizing and discriminating against the Jews. And Hollywood at that time were scared. They didn't want to talk about it, maybe because they wouldn't be able to sell movies, you know, in Germany and what have you. So everybody was kind of mellow. When they should have been speaking out, and if they had spoken out and been a little bit more forceful, maybe we would not have had the Second World War.
I doubt that.
Oh, listen, there's been a lot. But I don't want to argue that point right now. Let me finish, and then you can talk.
Thank you.
But I do believe we got to be outspoken, and we have to express what the Western values are, and not be intimidated by them because we think they may get some pleasure, you know, with us on our reaction.
Nigel.
I was just going to add, relative to my first comment, that yes, I mean, there is a danger that we justify their actions if we, you know, pay too much attention to it. But I also think when you look at France, it's not just the people of Paris who are going out on the streets.
Right.
The French government is very worried about the unity of France. And so the French government is looking at 10% of the population is Muslim, many of whom are very well integrated into the French system, many of whom are having problems with the French system. They're also worried about the attacks against Jews, and so then there's the Christian population. So what they're thinking of is unity, and this is one thing that comes up in all these speeches is unity, unity.
1-800-723-8029. I want to get your reaction if you're listening in Radio Land, wherever you are, coast to coast and border to border, whether or not the reaction, the Western reaction, the massive worldwide media reaction is playing favorably in the minds of ISIS and Al-Qaeda and those that might be susceptible to joining their cause against the West. I'm Bruce Dumont, live tonight from Culver City, California.
Headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
From Salisbury, North Carolina to Sacramento, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway each and every Sunday night from coast to coast and border to border. Sherry, you had a comment that you wanted to make.
Yes, Bruce. I mean, what struck me while we were talking about the whole question of unity and France coming together was basically the dynamic of the Jewish community in Paris and in France. This past year, the number of Jews who emigrated out of France elsewhere has doubled. There is a rise in anti-Semitism that started before all of this began, and I wouldn't call that coming together. And I think this may well have exacerbated this underlying stream of, and you have to call it, anti-Semitism that has been growing in France.
Nigel, you have been to the areas of Paris, the suburban and the neighborhoods of Paris, that are not the picture postcard version of Paris that we all know.
No, they are way outside the center. And this is, and I'd like to come back to the anti-Semitism in a second, but these are areas which are disconnected from Paris. So if you've ridden the Paris metro and you think how wonderful it is, not everybody gets to work getting on the metro. Some people take trains, and not only do they take trains, afterwards they have to take a bus. And then you're in a very disconnected suburb, and this is where it tends to be immigrants who came in from Northern Africa, and they have a very, very hard time finding jobs. And when they have a hard time finding a job, they get attracted to some of these ideas. So,
how does that that dynamic, how does that differ from East L.A. and the west side of Chicago, where there are economically disadvantaged people living? They have no hope for what their futures are like, and they are susceptible. They are susceptible to crime. They are susceptible to some degree of radicalization. Is there any difference, or is there a common denominator worldwide in your view, Rocco?
Yeah, I actually think there's a common denominator. Having been in the Philippines and you see Manila and you see the different economies there, is not unlike when I was a council member in the city of Oceanside here in California. You know, you had areas that were very fluent on the golf course, other ones down on the beaches, beautiful houses. And then you have barrios where the gangs are controlling it, and the number one thing is trafficking of drugs. So local leaders need to make sure that there's a rule of law, that they're safe, that kids have a way to get to school, that there's adequate funding. And so zoning becomes a big issue, and the issues Nigel's talking about is exactly right. At the very local level, you need to look at the total elements that provide a safe, vibrant economy for young children to grow.
Let's go to calls. Edward, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS Radio in Chicago. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen, ladies. I was watching the German news, and they were showing pro and anti-Islam immigration demonstrations. Do you see that happening in France?
Well, pro-Islam demonstrations?
Yeah, the media was a little bit up in arms about the increase in anti-Muslim immigration, and there were also pro-immigration. So do you see that battle playing out?
Let's let Nigel respond to that.
I think when you're talking about the German demonstrations, you're talking about the Pegida movement, the patriotic Europeans against the Islamization of the West. And that's in German. What you get in France, I think, is the rise of the Front National, the National Front, with Marine Le Pen. Mm-hmm. And she's the one who's talking about immigration. She's the one who's asking questions about, because it's the European Union. Well, what if somebody gets off on the coast of Italy? Do they arrive in France? And that's the National Front in France. And they're worried about that. And because of this event, their voters, they might get more votes.
But because of what transpired last week, that movement is likely to grow throughout Europe, is it not?
Yes. I mean,
that's
the
already exists.
Yes.
It that already is the exists there.
Yes.
That's the danger. But in Germany, for example, with the Pegida movement, that is primarily at the moment in East Germany, or eastern parts of Germany, former East Germany, not throughout Germany. And the German government and many German intellectuals are fighting back fiercely.
Alan, is there anything that the West can do to defuse this seething cauldron of young radicals who will kill themselves and risk their lives with the single goal of trying to kill as many from the West as possible?
Bruce, if I had the answer to that, I'd be probably be sitting in the White House and talking to some very important people.
Well, what do
you know,
think?
We had the radicalism here in our own country. We had
right.
the same problem with immigration. We have far-right individuals who are basically, in my opinion, bigoted. They make their whole political careers on scaring Americans and talking about assimilation. Fortunately for us, it is not as dangerous here in the United States as it is in some parts of Europe, because the alienation is not there. You know, there's the old joke of us here in California. If this white guy says, I'm a fourth generation Californian. And someone says, that's strange. You don't look Mexican. And the reason is because this used to be part of Mexico. And, the Latino population goes back generations.
But just to follow up on what you're saying, and again, I think we can say that it really sort of, what I'm about to say, really sort of began in California. And that is that was the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. It was the growth of the SLA. It was the murder of the Black Panthers by police, or the some would say murder or assassination by Los Angeles police officials. But the radicalization of this country in the 1970s, mid-70s, was happening out of Oakland, and there were a lot of divergent. They were speaking to the same disadvantaged, although many of them were educated, and were of affluence like Patty Hearst. But how did we go about diffusing that? Can anyone speak to
the economy?
I mean, everybody was alive during that period of time, but
the economy, things change, Bruce. And I mean, I was on the UC Berkeley campus when Mario Savio was doing mm-hmm. his thing. And part of it was a perception by the student body at that time that, you know, the American dream was moving away from them. Part of it, quite frankly, was this is really cool. Let's go sing the Yellow Submarine, which they did over and over again.
But how much of that was just anti-violence, anti-authority, anti-police?
It wasn't at that point yet anti-police
yeah.
in the 60s, in the late 60s.
Because yeah. I don't view that as an economic battle. Nigel, any thoughts?
I don't see that as an economic battle.
Rocky, you were...
Well, I think the economy is always a player, but I think the big issue in a society, and I think it's what makes the United States work so well, is the term leadership. I think people in the leadership role, be it a superintendent of a school, a council member, the president of the United States, we need to talk about the core elements that make this place great, like freedom and opportunity and jobs and family values and the issue of actually loving everybody. When you talk those issues and people feel included, then you don't have problems. But when you segregate and you say, secure the borders, we don't need any more Mexicans there, you know, when you start hearing things like that, then we start having a problem. And so leaders need to speak up and speak to the core principles of this country. And if France could do that and if other countries could do that, then they'll be fine.
Is there, and this is a touchy question because it deals with free speech, and we all say we love free speech, but is there a degree of greater responsibility that people with the pen should have in considering those that might be offended by what they write?
That's a loaded question.
It
is a loaded question. But I'm just saying, I mean, the world is now focused on a cartoonist and an office that to many people in the world went out of their way to be offensive to Muslims.
Listen, I see on the internet cartoons that I find offensive.
Right.
Very offensive almost every day. And right here in America, between those who absolutely hate Barack Obama to those who actually hate Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
We have that here in this country, and
right.
I find it very offensive. But I don't think anyone would think they were going to get up and go into their offices and start killing them because we find that so hateful. Now, there is – it changes, by the way, you know, from regions of the world. And I think there should be temper. I think if you're thinking of pinning something that actually you hope will create negative reaction from honest people, then you're probably doing more harm than good. But you should have the right to be able to do it.
You should definitely have the right to do it. And that's why that question, I wanted to make sure that the way I phrased the question, maybe I didn't phrase it right. But, you know, when I first saw the trailer for The Interview, what went through my mind immediately was, that's kind of odd. We're making a movie about an assassination of a world leader. How would we feel if people were making movies about the assassination of the president of the United States?
We had a movie set.
I know we did.
George W. Bush.
I know we did. And he's alive, and we know he's a little bit crazy, and we know he's a film fan. I mean, you're sort of asking for it.
I was North Korea, not
Bush. Yeah, North Korea, but you were not. You felt the same way I did.
Well, it could have been made. This is one of the things that I discussed in a group last night. It could have been made not with naming the main character as the real world leader. It could have been made not naming North Korea as the country. Charlie Chaplin had a great influence with the little dictator.
Right.
Everyone knew
who he's talking about.
It was Hitler. The character looked like Hitler, but it wasn't Hitler. But when we come back, I want to make the point that part of this is cultural.
I do want to get everybody's reaction to that, and I want to get the audience reaction to the question that I even posed. 1-800-723-8229 from coast to coast and border to border. Thanks very much for joining us tonight, live from Culver City, California.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sit cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
From Tyler, Texas to Tuscan, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8229. Time now for each of our guests to introduce themselves and tell the audience a little bit more about their background. Nigel Rabb, we welcome you back. Tell everybody who you are.
Thank you, Bruce. I'm happy to be back. I am an associate professor of Russian history at Loyola Marymount University, right near the ocean, with ocean views there. I study actually catastrophes in the Soviet Union in the 20th century, like floods, earthquakes, and all those things, which ultimately had a bad effect on the Soviet Union.
And we spent a lot of time talking with you last year about what's happening in Russia, and we'll talk more about that as the program unfolds this evening. Sherry Bibich, Jeffy.
I am a professor of the practice of public policy communication at the Price School at USC and a political analyst for the local affiliate of NBC, Channel 4.
Alan Hoffenblum.
I'm the publisher of the California Target Book, which is a subscription service that analyzes and handicaps legislative and congressional races here in California, and a former GOP political consultant for 30 years. I manage Republican campaigns here in California.
And a Vietnam veteran.
And a Vietnam
Eight
veteran.
Years, two
Air
terms.
Force.
Air Force. Rocky Chavez.
Yes, and I'm a politician. I represent the 76th Assembly District, about 500,000 people for people across the state. And I'm noted for having the best surfing in the United States, 3 best surf spots. Also, I'm honored to have all of Camp Pendleton with all of the Marines of the 1st Marine Division, 1st MEF in my district.
Mm-hmm. It's Carlsbad also, and you're former head of Veterans Affairs for the state of California, appointed by Governor Schwarzenegger.
That's correct.
28 years.
28 years in the Marine Corps, council member, 2 terms, Veteran Affairs, and now Assembly member.
Are you interested in seeking higher office at some point in your career?
I understand. I was just told I was looking for that. So I guess so.
Alan?
Well,
there's an open. So we should take a moment to, you know, go away from our conversation to talk about the big story in California politics. Is that longtime Senator Barbara Boxer announced last week that she would not seek re-election. So it opens up a huge opportunity for California Democrats. Does it open any opportunity at all for a California Republican to make it to the United States Senate, Alan?
It would be a major upset for a Republican to be able to win a statewide race. The reason being is that the Republican registration in the state has dropped precipitously. I mean, in the last 10 years, it's dropped almost 10 points. And particularly in a presidential election year, it would be a major, major upset, mainly because, by the way, the Latino vote and people of color have ceased voting Republican for quite a while. But the gentleman to my right, the assemblyman, is himself a Latino. And it might be very interesting if a highly qualified Latino Republican took a serious look, because we never know who might pop out of the Democratic primary.
And you are a Republican.
Wait a minute. There is no Democratic primary. That's the point.
Right.
Here, don't forget that we have the top two primary,
right,
which means it could be two Democrats who come out. It might be a Democrat and a Republican. And if there are two Republicans and 97 Democrats, and it may well be because every Democratic elected official in the state is looking at it, it might be two Republicans.
Rocky, you were elected to the California General Assembly by beating another Republican.
That's correct. And it was a great race because I was able to talk about things I cared about, and about education, about the economy, about jobs, you know, coastal community. But I like what Sherry's saying. I actually think it's going to be a very crowded Democratic field. I don't think the Republicans are going to be all that crowded for the discussions we just had. And I would like to highlight the last election, the Republican Assembly won four seats.
That's right.
For California, that's 2 million voters that flipped over from being supporting Democrats to be supporting Republicans. So the Republicans are on the rise. I'm on the election team for the Republican Assembly, and I'm predicting we're going to take another 2 to 4 seats again in 16.
Let me go back to the question of United States Senate. I mean, is there a Republican somewhere in the state of California, a Hispanic Republican that could get elected to anything at this moment, given the current climate, in your view, Rocky? And might you be that person?
I think any good candidate who talks about things that Californians care about, and obviously one of the big things for the Republicans has been immigration. When I came out for immigration reform right after being elected, and when I first did it, there were about two or three of us on it. But when it came before a vote in the Assembly, we actually had 17 Republicans in the Assembly support immigration reform. And so the Republicans have moved in that direction strongly. Education, we've been moving very strongly in that. I just was recently talking to people about the environment, understand global warming is a problem, and we have to have our own position for that, and especially with the Affordable Care Act and dealing with health. So I think a Republican that can actually deal with the issues people care about, message will carry, and also carry in Spanish.
No, Bruce, I don't see it happening. With respect, Assemblyman.
So you're throwing water on his candidacy right here.
He's too smart to run. Are you kidding me?
saying that. He has not. I've asked him twice. He did not say that. Twice I've asked him.
I know. Well,
he did not. No, there was no
Sherman-esque.
There was no Sherman-esque statement here.
I have learned never to say never in politics. But the reality is, oh, heaven forfend, I'm like Groucho Marx. I would never be a member of any club who asked me to come in. I mean, really? No, I mean, but what the California Republican Party has to face is the reality. I mean, that the National Party has soured the Republican brand for California. Everything that the Assemblyman says may be true with regard to California Republicans, but the big megaphone is with the guys in Washington.
I want to make a point. First of all,
finally,
the Democrats are diverse. You're going to have the progressive Democrats, the most liberal. They want Kamala Harris, the Attorney General of California.
The most attractive Attorney General
of the
United
States. The most liberal
States.
Of the candidates that are
Thank
being
you,
mentioned.
President Obama.
And then they're going to have the more business-oriented, more centrist Democrats are going to be looking at the candidates. Latino Democrats, who are very powerful within the party, are going to be looking at the candidates. No one's going to be able to clear the field. I don't think there might be 122 candidates on the ballot, but there's not going to be 122 serious candidates running. And it's also important, speaking as a Republican, that we have a good candidate running as a Republican for the United States Senate and not say, oh, it's not winnable, so we'll end up with some Tim Donnelly or some right-winger, you know, being the only one that files. So I hope we do find a good candidate to run for the Senate. And in politics, there are no certainties.
Would Carly Fiorina do it again? Would Carly Fiorina try it one more time?
I think she's looking for the presidency.
Meg Whitman?
No, not Meg Whitman. And I've been told that Carly Fiorina has actually moved out of the state.
Yes.
And is looking at the possibility of the presidency.
Let us get back to our discussion. And let's go to Barry listening to us online this evening. I understand he's listening in Mexico. Go ahead, Barry. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm listening in Mexico on internet phone, so I hope you understand me. I have a question and comment. Question is, how does everybody feel about Eric Holt participating in the march? Apparently he is in Paris. And second of all, what would happen if every newspaper, every magazine in the world published those cartoons daily for a month? It would certainly take the edge off everything. They would never be able to kill everybody, and maybe the world would make a stand someplace.
I'm going to take let's take each question because they're very good. Because in all of the descriptions of the 40 world leaders, I did not see one report that said anyone representing the United States was in that line.
Two.
Who were the two?
Well, apparently Eric Holder. I think they showed up at the Grand Synagogue. Eric Holder was in Paris for a conference. He was there, and the American ambassador to France was there.
But they were not walking in the front lines the leaders of the country. Well, not that I saw in my picture. Did you see it?
No, I didn't see. Okay. I didn't see it.
Well,
I don't know what the ambassador looks like.
Your point, Barry, is that Eric Holder was, you're alleging that he was not there. And I guess the question would be, if the others are world leaders, why did we not have a world leader there? Either the president or the vice president?
I think we were there purposely, and I think the reason is that Obama does not think we have Islamic terrorism. He talks about a lot of things. He never puts the two words together, and I think he didn't want to put the two words together in terrorists.
Okay, and your second question, repeat your second question, please.
I think it would have been interesting if every newspaper and every magazine in the world published all these cartoons every day for a month. I don't see how I think it would show that the world stands up.
What do we think of that idea? It's a bold move. Nigel, what do you think about it?
Well, I think the Charlie Hebdo, they did caricaturists.
They were caricaturists. Right.
I mean, their job was to poke fun at people. But the job of the New York Times is meant to be a serious, I guess, diplomatic newspaper. And same with the Times of London or Le Monde in Paris. So I don't think you could convince the New York Times to do that. They're not caricaturists.
What do you think of that idea?
Well, beyond the fact that, you know, each newspaper is going to make its own decision, I think that the gentleman is saying there just aren't enough terrorists to go around. There doesn't have to be. I mean, terrorists can pick and choose their targets, and it will have an impact on the rest of the world.
But would it have the impact, which I think Barry is suggesting, would it have the impact to basically say to the terrorists, you know what, if you think you're going to shut down our free press, you attack us the way that you attacked us, and we're going to respond tenfold. There isn't a newspaper in the West that is not going to be showing these pictures.
Wait a minute. And we're talking about newspapers, and right now, Bruce, no. Well, they are not the power in the media.
Or every news organization.
It's just not going to happen.
This is all speculative on our part. Barry's offered a suggestion. I heard a similar suggestion, by the way, a couple of weeks ago when Sony pulled the interview initially. The suggestion was that let's put it on every place. Alan, what do you think of the idea?
People who create these kind of terrorist acts, beheadings, killing innocent people, slaughtering people, are not reasonable people. They don't act reasonably, and we should not believe that all of a sudden those was in every media in the world that they would somewhat react reasonably.
Rocky, I've got to pause. We'll get your reaction in just a moment. 1-800-723-8289. Thank you, Barry, for listening to us in Mexico tonight. Back shortly from Culver City.
Are you headed to Los Angeles, looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a four-diamond hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
Bruce Dumont back in Culver City. Again, I just want to put this on the record because I think it's rather significant. The Prime Minister of France, Manuel Valls, offered a rather significant statement today, and I do want to share it with you. And he said, quote, this is a direct quote, "We are at war, not a war against a religion, not a war against a civilization, but to defend our values, which we are universal. It's a war against terrorism and radical Islamism, against everything that would break our solidarity, our liberty, our fraternity. Everyone must take responsibility, politicians and citizens alike. We cannot let pass a single one of these messages or a single one of these acts. Our indignation must be clear, total, and last forever and longer than 3 days. It must be permanent. We need standards, values, and authority. There must be a firm message about the values of the Republic and secularism. Journalists were killed because they defended freedom. Policemen were killed because they were protecting you. Jews were killed because they were Jewish." End of quote. Pretty strong statement from the Prime Minister of France.
I think everybody agrees we are at war. Where the disagreement is, how do we fight this war?
Right.
There's where the disagreement. Okay, we're at war. Are we going to send the 101st Airborne now over to Iraq and Syria and put troops on the ground? We're going to get involved in another ground war? What are the Europeans going to do? Most of them who, you know, really don't have strong defensive budgets. So the real question, and where Barack Obama should be having the leadership and taking the lead, is figuring out what is the strategy and what are the tactics to fight this war.
He's got a summit coming up on February 18th. Let me make one suggestion. The collective intelligence agencies of the world eavesdrop on mosques. They eavesdrop on mosques, because I think everyone at this table would acknowledge that in some mosques, not all, in some mosques, radical Islamism is being perpetuated by alleged religious leaders. Well, Nigel.
Well, if I could say two things. The second one is historical, but I imagine there's a lot of eavesdropping going on already.
Oh, I'm sure.
I mean, you can tell they're
doing
well.
I just wanted to put it out there.
But the one thing I just wanted to add from a historical perspective, because I am a historian, is that this is not a new phenomenon for France. And the example I like to bring is the Battle of Algiers, which talks about the Algerian liberation movement in the late 50s and the early 1960s. And the Battle of Algiers, it was actually an Italian director, shows that this is the French fighting terrorism in Algeria. So it's not French fighting terrorism in France. So that's very different. But this was a film that was actually recommended to American state officials after 2001. So the French, this is not something that is new. Their influence in Algeria has gone on for almost 200 years, and they're dealing with I guess a post-colonial situation where a lot of people from Algeria have now moved to France, and they're now part of France, and this is what they have to deal with. And so part of their war on terrorism is an understanding of how to integrate these disaffected groups in France. Many are well integrated, but many are not. I've said that before.
During one of the breaks, you made reference to criticism, what was happening in Russia insofar as criticism and Stephen Colbert. Put that on the record, because I think that was an important point you were making.
Yeah, I was just making a point about freedom of speech, and because the question came up, and that was a very good question by the caller. I mean, you know, where do we draw the line? And one of the things I said is that Colbert invited Pussy Riot. Pussy Riot was the punk rock band that went into the major church in Moscow and sort of desecrated parts of the church, and they were invited on a Colbert show, and it was this comedy show, and they made fun of Putin and they made fun of everybody. And so, you know, the question is, should he be allowed to do that? And I think, yes, he should be allowed to do that. But I think we shouldn't fool ourselves is that any Russian who will see this, or any, you know, Putin supporter in Russia, which is the majority, they're going to be offended by this. And so as collectively, we have to take that into our equation.
Will they see it? I mean, they'll have to go online if they want to see it.
Yes, in the case of them seeing it. But it's, I mean, I'm just thinking of that type of action, because there are other actions as well.
Well, this gets back to the question we're having about responsibility. We all may say that we believe in free speech, but some of us may question whether or not, or I will admit myself, is as much as I believe in free speech, I think with free speech comes a responsibility and a common sense.
Without question.
And if you go...
But who decides what's responsibility and what is common sense?
Well, in my case, I do. I will judge.
Okay, Bruce!
Okay. I think if you look in the United States, you know, we look and you go to the newsstand and you see the New York Times, the LA Times. But if you take, you know, if you fish around, you'll find some fringe publications that are going to be very, very offensive for one reason or another.
Let me take a stab. I see this issue of terrorism, and I think it's going to be a component of our world climate. I mean, mm-hmm. if you look back historically, you know, in the 1200s, it was the Mongol hordes. You knew they were going to come through, and they're going to come out of steppe, and they were going to rape and pillage. They did that for hundreds of years. That was part of the experience that formed that whole culture in Asia. We are going to see the same thing here. Until, just as the flu comes through every year, everybody worries about getting their flu vaccine. How many people are killed by the flu every year internationally? Yeah. A lot more than being killed by terrorism.
Right.
So it's a component of the world economy, of people being tied together, of seeing what's going on. The question we need is leadership to stand up and say, how are we going to operate in that sort of environment?
And what I've said after every one of these incidents, or a shooting at a mall or a shooting in a school, what amazes me, given the amount of guns that exist not only in the United States but in the world, and the number of people that are, they're coming out of this seething frustration, anger of young men and a growing number of women around the world who may be anti-American, anti-West. It amazes me that we don't see more of these incidents. And I think, unfortunately, I think we are likely to see more of these incidents because of the high degree of media coverage. And as we discussed in the answer to the first question, what terrorists look for is they look for media culture. They look for media exposure to absolutely frighten and terrorize those residents of either a city, a country, or the entire West. Live from Los Angeles, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by California Assemblyman Rocky Chavez, Republican from Oceanside and the Camp Pendleton area. Alan Hoffenblum, the publisher of the California Target Book and a longtime Republican activist in California. And Sherry Bibich Jeffy, she from USC and a longtime political analyst for KNBC. And Nigel Rabb, who is associate professor of Russian history at Loyola Marymount University. The program tonight coming to you from our home base in California, the Westwood One Studios in Culver City. Phone lines open toll-free, 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289, the email address, brucedumont@museum.tv. And if you want to tweet a comment or question, it's @Dumo. We've been talking primarily about the tragedy in Paris last week, and again, the huge outpouring of Parisians and French, and well beyond just the French, coming to the streets of France today, close to 3 million people, according to the Interior Minister, including 40 world leaders that were showing a solidarity against or for free speech and against turning their back on the terrorists that really just ripped apart that society and continue to cause problems around the world. I do want to pick up on that discussion. But again, I do not want to let the program go too far without spending some time with an expert who we got to know a number of times last year on this program when Russia and the Ukraine was really on the front page of every newspaper of the world. And I want to turn to you, Nigel, and just talk about it has been a year since you made your first appearance on this broadcast. What has transpired inside Russia in this past year? And is Putin in an ascending or descending position insofar as his popularity with the Russian people and the rest of the world?
That is a big question. Well, I think Russia is in crisis. There's no doubt about that. I think we saw the ruble fluctuate immensely over the last 3 or 4 months. I think the Russian government simply could not predict the fall in the oil prices. That has been a major factor, as well as the sanctions. And those two coming at the same time have had a major, major impact on the Russian economy in many ways. In terms of Russian companies who are seeking to borrow money from Western banks, that has been primarily blocked for them, so they can't service debts and loans. Another very big one are companies pulling out of Russia, not completing their agreements. Another big one, which I think is very important, is German companies over the last 10 or 15 years had actually found a way to work together on Russian soil. That is being limited at the moment. So that is an example of a very good working relationship, which is just disintegrating. That is deeply problematic. Putin, and this is a big contrast with the Soviet leaders, Putin has basically told the Russian people, we're going to hit a recession. We are in crisis. We have to buckle down here. So his popularity, I say, at the moment is not affected, but it risks within 12 months.
Now, the president and some world leaders were rattling the sabers about economic sanctions. What effect have those sanctions had? And again, the one that was the most difficult to sort of bring to that party, I believe, was Merkel in Germany. Is that correct? And has she changed her attitude at all?
It is correct. The sanctions, again, the sanctions have a larger impact on Germany than probably any other Western country, because the Germans are the ones who interact and sell manufactured goods to the Russians.
And they still do it,
but it's been hampered. The other one are the British in London. London has been criticized for continuing to service the financial needs of wealthy Russians, and that London is unwilling to actually really, you know, toe the line there. So that's a problem for the Germans, I suppose. But in Russia, I mean, people are here canceling their holidays. One of the interesting things, of course, if you're Russian and you cancel your holiday to France, where do you go? Crimean Peninsula.
Former Russian leader Mikhail Gorbachev, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, got worldwide attention this past week when he suggested that there might be a nuclear war because of what's happening in Russia. Your reaction to what he said, and how do you think it played inside Russia and around the world?
I think Gorbachev, who is only in power for about 5 or 6 years, is one of the most important leaders of the 20th century. But I think in recent years, he's been a little bit neglected or pushed to the side by recent events. And so at some level, I would say there's an amped up tone to what he says, because I have great respect for him. But I don't see a threat of a nuclear war as a result of what's happening in Ukraine. I think Gorbachev's perspective was coming from a man who in the late 80s put so much effort into arms reduction. I mean, continued discussions with Reagan about arm reduction, military reductions, and in fact for the Soviets of even evaluating their military budget. So he's coming from that perspective.
But wasn't one of his other points was that the Western leadership doesn't respect Putin?
He may be playing
very well at home, but he's not respected at all by any world leader anywhere.
Yes, Gorbachev would certainly, and he did that last year as well, he would be very concerned about the lack of respect shown, I wouldn't say to Putin, I'd say to Russian government, because Gorbachev was very worried about this in the Reagan years.
Well, Nigel, if I may, you know, Russia understands such a large country and a lot of resources. One of the things that has struck me odd is that the economy of California is actually the same as Russia. And if you look at the importance that Russia has in fuels, in particular Germany, and looking at how Germany's made a decision, a big investment into green energy, reducing their carbon footprint. What is the future of Russia? Are they going to be able to tie these resources together? Are they going to go from number 8th where they are with California down to number 12th or 15th?
Well, this is the big question, and I think a lot of people have criticized Putin for being too dependent on these natural resources that come from Siberia. Siberia itself is larger than the United States, as
right.
I put it in this perspective, and not diversifying the economy. And you hear this time and time again. For example, have you ever bought a Russian car? No. Have you bought a German car? Yes, some of us have. Have you ever bought something produced in France? You probably have. How about Japan, China, India? You've bought goods from all around the world, and yet you would be hard-pressed to come up with something that you have bought from Russia. So there's a deep criticism.
Vodka.
Okay, there we go.
Good point.
I didn't want to mention that one on the air. But so there's a deep concern that Putin is not diversifying the economy. And so they blame him for that. The only thing I would say is, was it any different in 1910? Was it any different in 1950? Was it any different in 1990?
Well, it will be different in 2050, though. Will it be different in 2050,
yes.
2080? Because I actually think the future of the United States and leadership is figuring out how we can tie in international trade and marketing with Asia, with the Pacific, with European. And that would be the strength of the United States today, to have that sort of leadership, as I was talked about earlier, since the containment theory's gone away. That's where we should actually have a soft spot, to have a greater vision of the world and how the United States plays it beyond running Navy and Marines around the world with guns.
When you're talking about leadership, I want to spend some time with you, Alan, and also the rest of the panel, and that's talking about the news of this past week that Mitt Romney has sent a signal that he may be seriously thinking about entering the race for president. That comes about 2 weeks after Jeb Bush saying the same thing. I know you don't think there's too much of a future for the Republican Party in the state of California other than being a fundraising funnel for whoever wants to run. And when we come back, I want to get your assessment of that. Also, Rocky, yours as well, as to whether or not the script that the Republicans must write if they're going to get support from the growing Hispanic community around the United States.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
From Skokie, Illinois to Sausalito, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. Well, about a year ago on this program, I made the comment that don't be surprised if Mitt Romney gets back into the race, because he looked pretty good. There were some good stories about him. There was a great documentary that got rave reviews when it opened at a film festival in California, and so I said, watch out for Mitt Romney, and it appears that he's hearing Hail to the Chief in his ears again, Alan. Does that make you happy that Mitt Romney might get back in this race?
I don't think he should. First of all, I want to know which Mitt Romney is going to be running for president of the United States.
Right.
Is it the Mitt Romney now? He's going to go back to the Massachusetts governor, Mitt Romney, that's going to be a little bit more tolerant on issues related to immigration? And or is he going to be the Mitt Romney that went so far right and, you know, on issues such as immigration? Which Mitt Romney are we going to see? And is it going to be the Mitt Romney, you know, who talked about the 47%? There's a reason he lost the election. And I think if he starts to run, people are going to start remembering why he lost the election. But if he wants to, there's going to be, you know,
but isn't he doing this because he wants to stop Jeb Bush? What other reason would he, Sherry? What do you think?
Well, I think that is a part of it. I think he well, we don't know if he's going to do it yet, yeah. But I think he is also looking at the possibility that both Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton have an Achilles heel, and it is that they're apparently. A very good article by Dan Baltz makes the point that Americans appear to have a distaste for dynasties, and that includes both the Bush dynasty and the Clinton dynasty, and that leaves an opening for Romney. And, you know, third time's the charm, I guess.
Well, I want to make a remark that Dan Baltz column. He wrote a column based on a focus group of 12 people
yeah.
in one state, of which 50% were able to identify the U.S. Senator from Massachusetts. That's not a representative focus group, let me tell you.
No, but I do think there are other surveys which back that up.
But the basic story was that they didn't want Bush and they didn't want Clinton. They wanted to move on. They wanted new faces.
They wanted the future.
No, Romney's not a new face.
Let me ask Rocky, the only elected official amongst us who was able to make it through and get Democratic votes to get elected to the General Assembly or the Assembly in California. How do you look at that field and who in that field of 16 names that have been floated, who in that field do you believe would be most effective in speaking to the Hispanic communities of California?
Jeb Bush.
Why? Just because he speaks Spanish?
And actually, I think the Bush name is seen very favorably in the Latino community. I think Jeb Bush coming from Florida, Jeb Bush dealing with those issues before, I think he's clearly one of the best.
And he has a more moderate immigration reform stance.
And he values families and education and a lot of the things the Latino community talks about. And, you know, and as far as dynasties, I mean, you just think about it. You know, the Kennedys, even California, Brown. How many Brown governors have we had in California?
Two.
But how many times have they served as governor? Six.
Oh, well, that's another story.
So, you know, even down in San Diego, you know, Hunter, you know, you had one congressman and somebody plays him. Yeah, the voters, for some reason, will vote for a name they've seen before. You know, people like us who follow, you know, every twist and turn know somebody. It's always amazing to me, even for myself, in my own little district, people say, God, Rocky, we really like what you're doing. The Oceanside City Council, you're doing a great job. And I don't have the heart to tell them. I've been gone for 5 years.
Yeah.
So they just know your name's there, and they know you were at that point.
The bottom line, it gets down to the individual and the campaign. I remember back in the 1960s, I don't remember my liberal friend said, oh, we can't have a Kennedy dynasty. There are too many Kennedys. They couldn't wait to see every Kennedy possibly could to be elected to some type of office. It depends on what type of campaign Jeb Bush runs, what type of campaign Hillary Clinton runs, what type of campaign those who are going to challenge Bush and Clinton, what kind of campaigns are going to run, and who would the American people think will be able to provide some leadership, you know, for this country. I think both Republicans and Democrats have a chance to win in 2016. And I'm hoping that we have a little better presidential race. I thought the race between Mitt Romney and Obama was atrocious. I thought the Republican primary for Romney to get the job was atrocious. So,
which they've changed.
Yes, I hope.
They've changed. Maybe for the better. We will know that. But others in that field, but again, I guess the question that I'm coming back to is you have, again, according to the national analysis of this, you have this huge pocket of money that's out there, and Jeb Bush sucked up a lot of it with his flirtation, and Romney is holding on to a goodly amount in that pot, and he doesn't want to release it at this particular moment because he believes, I think, that it would all go to him. Maybe some of it would go to Chris Christie, but I think Chris Christie is fading as a national figure. Do you agree with that or not?
I'm not sure he ever was a truly national figure.
I didn't think he was.
He might have been a national Republican figure, partially because of his tenure as chair of the Republican Governors Association. Mm-hmm. The man has so much baggage. Even in New Jersey, he is not very popular. That's my home state. And someone sent me a wonderful bumper sticker, my governor can eat your governor. That's basically the perception.
But let's get back to Clinton and Bush. I find, by the way, it's not their last names. But the political left has never liked the Clintons, and the political right have never liked the Bushes.
Right.
So I think it's politics that is where they're getting their opposition, and people are just
using the dynasty
as a, you know, as a issue. But again, it's going to depend on what kind of campaign Jeb Bush pushes together. And the same thing with Hillary.
What about the other candidates, though? Because if Romney and Bush both represent some degree of yesterday, the rest of that field really are people that have not run before.
And you think Ted Cruz is today?
Well, I'm saying
in the Republican
I would put Huckabee in the list of someone who is yesterday, but he may have a stronger, firmer ability to get at least one section of the Republican Party, but I don't know whether that's enough to win a primary.
The Republican could very well nominate somebody who could not be elected president of the United States.
Oh, yeah.
They've proven that.
Yes.
They've got a good record of that.
The Republicans?
Yeah.
Alan, I think your key point is that it depends on how they run the campaign, you know.
Oh, sure.
It always does.
Who's the candidate, how they run it, and there's that other thing out there you don't know, and that's something happens like happened in Paris the other day that'll capture everybody's attention right before they vote. So I'm hopeful that that's why we have primaries and Republicans don't have a candidate.
Look what happened to McCain. I mean, he looked like he was actually catching up on Obama and the economy collapsed, and that was into the race.
I asked this question last week, and I want to ask everyone to respond. We'll start with you, Nigel, and that is whether or not a campaign for president of the United States is the place and should be the place for a real knockdown, drag out discussion, debate amongst the American people about the role of America in the world, and does it open up a serious opportunity for a serious discussion about whether the United States should be pulling back, and I will use the isolationist word, even though I know a lot of people don't like the use of that word, but I'm wondering whether or not Americans are war weary. They are weary of being out front on leading on every single issue as a result of the whole war. And there's a lot of Americans, at least, that call this program, they say, you know what, we don't want to do it anymore.
I don't know how one can be isolationist anymore with the speed with which people move around the world, the speed with which information moves around the world. At one level, just in terms of information, I don't know how we can be isolationist. The other one is the economies. I mean, historians like to point out that already in the 16th century, 500 years ago, there was a linked economy between Spain and China. Today, our economies are so linked. If China decides to do something radical with all the dollars it owns, this will be felt by the United States. And I think as we talk about earlier in the program, we talked about fighting terrorism. This has to be a coordinated effort between many, many countries. And that was just that example. But the economies now are so intertwined. People move around between so many countries nowadays. Goods, when you go to the port of L.A., where are all these goods coming from that flow into the United States? They're not coming from...
But I think fighting terrorism, I think, is an issue that the American people do support. It's where we send our troops. And you alluded to that in the last hour, Colonel. You know, where do we send our troops? Because a lot of Americans don't like to be sending troops any place anymore. And I think we all realize that sometimes when you're in a war, you can't win a war from 30,000 feet by dropping bombs or.
Well, let's be clear. The reason this war went on for so long, in over a decade, was because of two major issues. One is there was no personal investment by the majority of society. Only 1% of the people actually enlisted and went off and did this. And when I was the secretary, I used to go around, I used to see people coming back, and people are at the mall. They didn't care about the veterans and what was going on. And the second issue is we put it on a credit card. If we would have actually raised taxes to pay for it, you'd have seen people take a totally different perspective. If you had had a draft or you would have had the taxes, this thing would not have gone so far forward. So I think what's going to happen in the presidential election, I hope they do have an intelligent discussion on the future. I agree with Nigel. We're interlinked. Going back is not going to work, but it's always going to come down to the economy, and it's going to come down to opportunities for your child and for your future, for your grandchildren. What is the opportunity? Are we going to be in a class society of a haves and have-nots? And that's where the Republicans got to stand up and say, you know what? The trickle-down economics doesn't work. We want everybody to be rising in society.
And when it comes to the presidential campaign, remember, it's going to be the key states, the swing states, and the issues and the opinions of the voters in those states will be dominating the discussion of our presidential candidates.
So President John Kasich could happen.
Could.
1-800-723-8289. Oh, I thought he wants to run again.
No, he doesn't.
1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border tonight from Culver City, California. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
Bruce Dumont back in Culver City. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. We'll be here for the next several weeks in California. And then we will head back to Illinois, where it is very, very cold. I'm sorry that I'm missing that. Well, I'm actually not sorry that I'm missing it, but I'm enjoying being in California. Let me put it that way.
In the rain.
Around the table this evening, we have some new friends. We have some old friends with us for many years. And let's begin with Sherry Bibich Jeffy, who will introduce herself. And you have been a guest on this program probably for the last 15 years. On my trip
since
South
I was
California.
12, Bruce,
since
yes.
I found you in high school.
That's
and,
right.
And you've grown.
I was precocious.
You've grown well.
Thank you, and I appreciate it. And I've had fun every time I've done this show. In case you hadn't found out who I am a professor of the practice of public policy communication at USC and the political analyst for KNBC in Los Angeles. And I am one of the four political junkies. Oh, five political junkies in this studio.
And Alan Hoffenblum, I think our friendship goes back about 15 years as well.
Yes, quite a bit. Yep. I think it started during the governor's recall election, the recall election. Yes, I'm a former Republican operative. I'm not involved with the Republican Party any longer. I published the California Target Book, which is a nonpartisan subscription service that analyzes all the races for Congress and the state legislature in California.
Nigel Rabb, we met last year, but again, you've become a regular guest on this show.
Yes, and I am an associate professor of Russian history at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, right nearby the studio. And I suppose in our discussion on Mitt Romney and presidents, I'd be more concerned is who's going to be the next Russian president and if it's going to be the dynasty called Putin dynasty. That would be my greater concern, I think.
And making his first appearance is California Assemblyman Rocky Chavez.
Yes, and it's great to be here. You know, something I haven't told you, I'm actually from Los Angeles, born just a few miles south of here. And my family, my mother was here for a generation. So they've been here about 200 years, but my father came across as immigrants working in the fields in about 1910. Mm-hmm. So I consider myself a strong Californian and love being an assembly member and working for all Californians up in Sacramento.
When the national news media and when political talk show hosts start talking about illegal immigration, which obviously has been a third rail issue for Republicans, more so than Democrats for the last maybe 20-plus years, how has that debate played within the Hispanic community in California? The popular position is that if you want to crack down on illegal immigration, that has been projected by the media as being anti-immigrant. Do you think that's a fair assessment of how it's being heard by Hispanic Americans living in Los Angeles and in the area that you represent?
Well, I know it is. I know I've talked for the past 2 years, I've been going around the state doing small focus groups And if you actually talk to the Latino community and things they're concerned about, education, opportunity for jobs, safe communities, you know, as I joke around with my friend, Second Amendment, and I'm a member of the NRA, and they said, when you talk about Second Amendment, they look at you. But if you talk about somebody who they know in their family has been shot by a gang member with a gun, they understand that. And so Republicans need to communicate to them. And as far as immigration, as I always talk to my Republican friends, I say, what we need to do is understand the difference between citizenship and residency. And residency is people who are here, part of our society, paying taxes, making things happen, and working very well. In fact, my brother-in-law is a resident, a green card here. So I think once you start talking about that in a vibrant society, then we'll be relevant. But when you start throwing the term illegal in the beginning, everybody just shuts off. So Republicans need to understand that we're a party of opportunity. We care about education. We care about safety in your communities. And we want you to flourish and ensure your children have a great future.
But to someone who is either a second or third generation American from Mexico who did it the legal way, do they resent those that they perceive to be butting in line and sneaking into the country and not paying the dues that that let's say your parents and you have paid?
I hear do not hear that often very much, very 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 lightly. And as you know, actually, when my father came in here, it was just come across the border. It was a totally different system. Mm-hmm. So as I always talk to Republicans, they said, well, that's the law. I said, what does the Assembly and Senate actually do in California? We make the laws. And so if there's an inequity there and there's an issue that we need to deal with, then we can deal with it. So I think that's a red herring going off in a direction we're not going to go. Clearly, we have millions of people here. Clearly, they're being part of our educational institution. One of the strongest growing entrepreneur groups are Latina women, and a lot of them are here on, residency, not necessarily citizens. So it's a recognition of how we want this vibrant society. And if you think about other cultures, look at Japan. I mean, where they have a very strong immigration rule, they have now a problem. They don't have young people. It's a society that has an issue of just taking care of the elder population. Immigrants, people coming to your country, add a lot of strength to our country. That's why California is so rich.
We're going to go to calls. Let's go to Brian listening to us on WLS Radio in Chicago. Go ahead, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. Before the break, you were talking about the global economy, and then I like to tie it to the global war on terror. And, you know, as an American taxpaying citizen, what we're tired of is we're getting the bill. America spends all the money and sacrifices all the blood and treasure, while the rest of the world seems to, you know, ride on our coattails. And we need to correct that. You know, Bush thought he could, you know, fight a war on a credit card, which obviously did not work. And we need to get the rest of the world paying the bill for this war on terror. I mean, you know, we got the Saudis funding the terrorists, you know, and the other Gulf State Arabs that we never talk about. We need to talk about who's funding the terrorists, and then we need to talk about who is going to pay the bill.
Brian, would you acknowledge, though, just in the – because of so much focus has been on France this past week, and virtually I've heard in numerous interviews by, with American intelligence officers – they have said that they believe that France is one of the most aggressive allies we have in the war on terror. And clearly, I don't think, and certainly I think in the future, I don't think you could say that France is shirking its responsibility in fighting terror. And I don't think you could say that about England either. Could you? I mean,
right.
Really?
Or Germany, for that
matter. Or Germany. I mean, they
right,
take it seriously because they are equally potential victims, as we have seen, you know, an attack in Paris is going to get as much exposure as an attack in New York or in London.
Or Australia.
My comment would be, I know the Europeans have Muslims like we have Mexicans. I understand that. I know 10% of France is Muslim Africans. I understand that. But the number of Frenchmen dying in Afghanistan and Iraq is nowhere near the number of Americans. That's the problem. And, you know, most of America just wants to tune out and not pay attention, and they don't want to pay high taxes, and they don't care, unfortunately.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that. Unfortunately, I wish that I had the official statistics in front of me, but I would bet that obviously the vast majority of those who have died in the war on terror as soldiers have been Americans. But I would say there's probably a significant number of Brits and French and Canadians and other
Australians
that have also lost their lives in doing that.
Right, but one other comment. You know, one of the failings of the global economy is, I think Ralph Nader said it best. You know, the global corporations, they want to privatize the profits and then socialize the risks and the costs. And we have these companies like Walmart and Apple Computer that want to exist out in the ether and pretend they're not a member of any country and just hang on to all their money, and then look the other way when, say, China steals our high-tech information and hacks our computer systems and does all kinds of mischief around the world. And then we're supposed to say, okay, American taxpayer, now you spend billions of dollars countering the Chinese while we hang on to all of our money. That's the problem. We need to get global world corporations paying the freight for being a global citizen.
Let's let Nigel tackle that, and then we're going to move on.
Well, I think I would just tackle the very beginning, which was the Iraq War, and that was a very controversial war. It wasn't as if the governments around the world said, no, we're not participating, or we're participating less because we're simply not willing to pay for it. There was a lot of opposition in Canada, in France, in Germany to active participation. And so the politicians in all those individual countries, being elected officials, they said, well, if I actually support the war, I won't be elected again. So that was part of the democratic procedure that went along with the Iraq War, and one could say it was just a bit of a very expensive fiasco at some level in the United States.
Let's go to Mike listening to us on KXLY in Spokane, Washington. Go ahead. Congratulations to the Seahawks.
Thank you, Bruce. The Seahawks, yes.
Future Super Bowl team, right?
I know you're a big Seahawk fan. Go ahead. What can we do for you?
Yes, I am. And a Happy New Year, Bruce. My question is on the poor here in America. And what happens to the millions today who have lost their unemployment benefits? They have no income. For those who have no skills and are on the street, what will America be like 3 to 5 years from now? And both political parties could do more.
Actually, I like to talk about that. What we're doing in California is just recently we've doubled down on adult education because, as you know, people starting in a career can't expect to do it for 40, 50 years. There has to be retraining programs at 35, 45, 55. So we're doing that, and we're actively involved in our community colleges for new training in biochem and agriculture and a lot of the new technologies going around California. So we are retraining our own citizens for a global economy.
And the president wants free community college for all. Listen, thanks very much. We've got to move on. 1-800-723-8229. One more segment, and boy, do we have a doozy planned for you. Back shortly.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sit cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Bruce Dumont back in Culver City, final segment tonight. I would like to return to the topic that we began our broadcast with this evening and ask everyone to sort of summarize. We're talking about what the West, not specifically the United States, but obviously the U.S. and the West, is there anything that we can do other than stepping up our vigilance and our aggressive action as far as intelligence is concerned? Is there anything else we could be doing to reducing the likelihood of terrorist acts against the West. Nigel?
I guess coming from the perspective of a historian and maybe a social historian, I think, and having visited Clichy-sous-Bois outside of Paris, one of the most important things to do is to eliminate unemployed young men who have, you know, who have a time on their hands to actually get exposed to these ideas. One has to find ways to get them jobs. One has to find ways to integrate them into the communities. Because when we speak of France having 10% Muslim population, many of those people are actually well integrated into France. And many of those people are bilingual, Arabic, French, and there's no problem with that. They get along fine. They are in the marches in Paris today promoting the unity between Christians or Catholics or Christians and Catholics. Jews and Muslims. So this integration is critical. And just because in 2005, there were riots across France. Those riots were disaffected youth who came from these banlieues, these suburbs. And it wasn't about terrorism in 2005.
As a historian, whenever there's a problem within a country, there's a political climate that exists. And sometimes into that vacuum steps a charismatic leader who decides that it's us against them. And it rallies the masses, and them becomes a major problem. Do you think that political climate exists now in France and elsewhere in Europe, that there could be a rise of a collective movement? I don't just mean in one country, that could focus on more aggressive action amongst Muslims living in that region.
Yes, I think we have to be concerned about the rise of nationalism throughout Europe today, because we were talking about earlier the rise of anti-Semitic attacks. So yes, the leader in France would be Marine Le Pen, who got 25% of the vote in the last election. I don't see her as being that charismatic leader to do what we've seen in the past. However, I think there's room for concern there.
Can I sort of flip that? Here's what really concerns me. Yes, there is an economic component and there is a cultural component, which is harder to deal with because cultures do differ and it requires a different political socialization. It does also, as you mentioned, requires leadership. But here's what I see, Bruce. With whom do we negotiate? Obama can talk till he's blue in the face with the president or the prime minister of France or Angela Merkel. But they're really – you can't talk state to state anymore. Leadership is diffuse, and it's diffused among all of these other non-governmental groups such as ISIS, such as al-Qaeda. And I don't know how the West deals with that.
Alan.
The pilots that flew into the World Trade Center, the Saudis, were not a bunch of poor kids from the barrios. Nope. They were from wealthy families. It's much more complex. I mean, we got other people with pay scales that are supposed to be able to tackle this problem other than us at this table. But right now, it is a lack of leadership throughout Europe, throughout America, who at this time did not seem to have any real serious plan or strategy, you know, to resolve this thing, and hopefully eventually it will come about.
Are drone attacks part of the strategy?
Drone,
part of that strategy is you kill them before they kill us.
That's not strategy. That's tactics. That's a matter in which you follow through on whatever your strategy is. The problem with the drone attacks, there doesn't seem to be any strategy behind it other than
hit them.
You know, kill somebody because we got a leak some information. And here we are sitting in Virginia, dropping bombs in Afghanistan. The technology is unbelievable. But that's just a tactic. I mean, whether we use drones, pilots, or the first airborne, that's a tactical decision. But that has nothing to do with whether or not it's going to be successful in the ultimate.
In response to 9/11, President Bush said, we want to fight them there so we're not fighting them in New York and on the streets. And hasn't that strategy worked?
That was rhetoric, and it got the wrong generals and the wrong people and made the
Iraqi. Was the rhetoric right?
Yes, it was, in my opinion.
You agree with that, Rocky? Was that rhetoric right? And do we now have, almost 15 years later, we have wars that are going on elsewhere. We have terrorism that's going on elsewhere, including in our allies with France, but we're not having it in the United States
I think the issue was right after 9/11, the decision to go to Afghanistan and go after them was the exact right thing, and we should have done it. Where we made the mistake is when we expanded it into Iraq. And the other thing that we need to look at also is if you look at prior military engagements, when Grant became the general, he fought throughout the entire war. When Eisenhower went off, he fought throughout the entire war. We didn't have a 12-year war. We had a series of generals that did one-year wars. We always had the new team going in. So we need to relook how do we actually complete wars from a military standpoint.
I would just add in terms of comparing 9/11 to what happened in France. I mean, 9/11, thousands of people died.
Yes.
In France, in terms of the death toll, it would be like a school shooting in the United States. I mean, these are vastly different. So expecting a repeat of 9/11 is very, very difficult. That was such a vastly out of scale with many other events.
But we do know that there's a growing number of people in the world that want to pull that off again.
Yes.
9/11 is a repeat of 9/11 is the goal of literally perhaps hundreds of thousands of people around the world as we listen to this broadcast this evening. And that's a new reality of where we are in 2015. Our thanks this evening, Nigel Rabb. Thank you very much. Sherry Bibich, Jeffy, Alan Hoffenblum, Rocky Chavez, nice to have you with us on this broadcast. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with Westwood One Radio this evening. Our thanks to Anderson Cowan, Alex Hardy here in beautiful Culver City, along with Ted Woods, Colin Bobbitt back home in Chicago. We thank you all. This program says goodbye from Culver City, California.